Okay, I think we're about ready to get started. Good to see everybody tonight. We have visitors with us. Welcome to our auditorium Bible study as we're going through the entirety of the Bible in a little over 4 years. But right now, in this quarter, we're in the period of the United Kingdom, and we're, if you will, smack dab in the middle of the reign of David. So we're looking at part of that tonight. We'll be looking primarily in 2 Samuel 9 and 10. We'll have to do some background work before we get into that. But we'll be looking at David's care of Mephibosheth and his defeating the Ammon and Syria in a series of campaigns. It's an important section, the middle part of David's reign. It tells us a lot about the expansion and security of the kingdom that he was reigning over. Also, we see more about his character and the character of his men that are under his control. And I think there's a couple of good lessons to learn, certainly at least, in tonight's material. So again, we'll be looking at David's kindness to Mephibosheth in 2 Samuel chapter 9, and him defeating Ammon and Syria in 2 Samuel 10. The map there is of where Ammon and Syria were. To get the background on Mephibosheth, who really comes square into the story in 2 Samuel 9, we need to go back and think about Saul, Jonathan, and what happened to them, where Mephibosheth comes from, David's covenant with Jonathan concerning their mutual descendants and all of that. All of that comes into the story in 2 Samuel 9. Actually, all kind of comes together in 2 Samuel 9. So we need to go back and get this background, and that's what we'll spend the first few minutes of class doing. We'll look at the death of Saul in 1 Samuel 31. I know this was covered not too long ago. I think I was in Africa at the time, but I know this was covered not too long ago. But if you remember, if you're looking at 1 Samuel 31, the Philistines fought against Israel. The men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons. The Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, Malchishua, Saul's sons. The battle became fierce against Saul. The archers hit him, and he was severely wounded by the archers. So Saul had six children. Three of them were with him in this battle that's described in 1 Samuel 31. We sometimes call it the Battle of Mount Gilboa. It's on the edge of the plain of the Jezreel Valley. But Saul is, as we just read, badly injured. He then tells his armor bearer to just go ahead and kill him so that the Philistines would not be given the honor of doing that. The armor bearer was afraid to do that, and so Saul falls on his sword and kills himself, and when the armor bearer sees that, he falls on his sword as well. And so there's the sad end of the first king of the United Kingdom, the sad end of Saul. And of course, we have studied much about him this quarter, seen his frailties and his faults and the reason that he was rejected from being king. And we understand the justice of God, but that doesn't make it any less sad that Saul came to the end that he did. Well, this left Ishbosheth, Saul's son, to rule over Israel. In 2 Samuel chapter 2, verses 10 and 11, the text says that Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel. He reigned 2 years. Only the house of Judah followed David, and followed David for 7.5 years. I'm not sure 100% what happened to those other years that Ishbosheth isn't said to have reigned over the other part. It's sometimes assumed that he there was not a king. He was ruling, but he wasn't reigning over that time. Maybe Abner was. There were different ideas about that, but whatever the case is, he does become the ruler of the north, at least for a while. Jonathan has a son, as we've already mentioned, by the name of Mephibosheth, and it's him that we're interested in, particularly in 2 Samuel chapter 9, when we get there in just a minute. Mephibosheth was 5 years old when his father Jonathan and his grandfather Saul were slain there on Mount Gilboa. In 2 Samuel 4 and verse 4, you have this recorded. Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel, and his nurse took him up and fled. And it happened as she made haste to flee that he fell and became lame. His name was Mephibosheth. So we learn something of Mephibosheth's history, how he became lame, when he became lame. So this obviously is an extra tragedy, if you will, that occurred to the house of Saul, here to Jonathan's son, at the very time that Saul and Jonathan were slain. But by the time of today's story, when we go over to 2 Samuel chapter 9, Mephibosheth himself has a young son named Micah. And so that'll come into the story a little bit. So time has gone on. And there must be at least 15 plus years, I'd guess more like 20 years, that have elapsed since Saul was slain and Jonathan were slain at Gilboa, and Mephibosheth suffered his injury. One other aspect that you have to review to really understand what goes on in 2 Samuel 9 is the covenant that was made between David and Jonathan. We looked at this, I say covenant, although it was repeated several times, that David and Jonathan made an agreement to protect one another and even to protect one another's descendants. Their friendship, as you recall, went through a lot of trials and tribulations, a lot of tests, and yet it remained strong. Saul was trying to kill David. Jonathan loved David. So here, Saul, Jonathan's father, is trying to kill him many times, but Jonathan loved and protected David. So they made a covenant, as we've said, between them that included the mutual protection of one another during this time when Saul is hunting David, but also the mutual protection somewhat of their descendants. So we read on one occasion, 1 Samuel 20 in verse 14, Jonathan says, "You shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. Know not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies." So there's this covenant they make to protect one another. And again, the insistence is protecting one another's households, the houses, the descendants, from there forward. You have also 1 Samuel 20 and verse 42, when they meet again and leave with the covenant restated. "Go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, 'May the Lord be between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" And that seems to be also restated in 1 Samuel 23 and verse 18. All right, so that's all of the background, and you're probably saying, "Okay, Steve, we know all that." You should know all that. So if that was new to you, you're failing in your learning, okay? So just to be clear about that. I think everybody who's been in the class would could have told me everything I just told you, probably. So that gets us then finally to 2 Samuel 9. With the undergirding of what we just read, that Jonathan and David promised one another not to cut off kindness from my house forever. Okay, so their descendants would be a part of this. 2 Samuel chapter 9. Let me get over there. David said, and this is after some of the military victories that we looked at last class period. David said, "Is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" What a great question. You know, what a wonderful inquiry that David has here. He doesn't know of anybody from Jonathan's house, perhaps, that he could show kindness to. But he remembers a promise that he made. He remembers a covenant that he made to somebody who, now remember, at this time would have been long dead. This would have been many years ago, but it comes to David's mind. And you wonder what precipitated that. We have moments in our lives where we're just in quiet meditation and old friends may come to mind who maybe have passed on, family members or people who are close to us or people who helped us in times past, and we are just, you know, remembering all of that, reveling in it somewhat, and something like that must have happened to David for him, for this question to come to his mind. And he realizes that he owes a debt to Jonathan, a promise that was made. So David's words in 2 Samuel 9 and verse 1 are really proof that he has not forgotten, I should say, this covenant. Let's read the next few verses. There was a servant in the house of Saul named Ziba, and when they had called him to David, the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" He said, "At your service." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show the kindness of God?" And Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan who is lame in his feet." So the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "Indeed, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel in Lodabar." King David sent and brought him out of the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodabar. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, had come to David, he fell on his face and prostrated himself. David said to Mephibosheth, and he answered him, "Here is your servant." So David seeks a descendant of Saul. He's told by Ziba of Mephibosheth in the house of Machir. And then David indicates that he wants to keep his promise that was made through the man that we were introduced to in to the man who we were introduced to in 2 Samuel 4 and verse 4. I didn't know or remember if I knew where Lodabar is. And that, you know, when I see a geographical place that I can't picture in my head, I don't know how you guys think about the text, but I like to be able to picture things in my mind, locations especially. Where is this in relation to where we're talking about? And so I didn't know where Lodabar was or didn't remember. It is right there. So now you have the picture in your mind where it would be from Jerusalem, where David is. That's up a ways, up in the north country. And there, from there, David sends to bring Mephibosheth down. David is just going to make wonderful provisions for this man. And I want to read, just go ahead and read the next part of this chapter. As David is now speaking to Mephibosheth, he's been brought down from Lodabar. And David says to him in verse 7, "Do not fear, for I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually." And he bowed himself and said, "What is your servant that you should look upon such a dead dog as I?" I might say that Mephibosheth shows all the way through, even to the end of the story, which we won't get to today, of his life, shows all the way through an extraordinary amount of humility, some real righteous character. It's going to come out a little bit later on, even though he's maligned. He's a good man. He's obviously a man who has a physical disability. So with all of that together, he's somebody that you would think would be easy to show kindness to. And I think David finds it easy to show kindness to a person of Mephibosheth's situation and his quality. But you see his humility here. The king called Ziba, and Saul's servant, said to him, I've given to your master's son all that belonged to Saul and to all his house. You therefore, your sons, your servants, shall work the land for him. You shall bring in the harvest that your master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's son, shall eat bread at my table always. Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants, so Ziba was pretty well responsible and blessed as well. Ziba says to the king, according to all that my lord the king has commanded his servant, so will your servant do. Now, later in the story, that we won't get to it tonight, but Ziba, in fact, turns on Mephibosheth and is not going to be true to him. But as for at this point, he pledges loyalty. And again, David says, Mephibosheth is going to eat at my table like one of the king's sons. We'd be hard-pressed to probably understand in our culture what an honor that would be to eat at the table of the king, be a part of the king's court on a regular basis. But here's a man who was lame in his feet, was living kind of nowhere in somebody else's house, and didn't have any prospect in life or much of anything. And David elevates him from just nowhere to being part of his royal court. And Mephibosheth realizes, as we said, what's being done for him. In verse 12, Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah. I mentioned that. And all who dwelt in the house of Ziba were servants of Mephibosheth. So he dwelt in Jerusalem and did eat continually at David's table. What do we learn from this story? What do you get out of this in terms of lessons, things that we can learn that would help us be pleasing to God?
Yeah. So even thinking back on this covenant and Jonathan, he could have considered it fulfilled or waited for an opportunity from him to do good. Instead, he sought out a chance to do better.
Yeah. That's just really a great observation. A lot of us, I think, would have, as Colton's saying, might have, if we had an obligation or we made a promise and the person passed away and we didn't know of any people that this would really apply to, we'd probably just let that slide. You know, we'd think to ourselves, well, if an opportunity arises, I'll try to do something. But David's of a different character. You know, he seeks out this person to fulfill his promise to, and at some considerable sacrifice to himself, obviously, although he was a king and had great possessions at this point, yet David wants to do that, and that should be the way we are. We should want to keep our promises. We should want to do good to others, especially when we've covenanted to do so, and seek that out. Anybody else have a thought? You want to, Lorenzo? Yeah, and I might say, I hope you heard what Lorenzo's saying. You know, the kindness of God there. David wants to show somebody from the house of Jonathan the kindness of God. And that phrase is really interesting to me too. And I think if we think about it, you might remember about how David felt about his own blessings that he had received. He said something very similar in a psalm of praise to God. Who am I that you have brought me thus far? Who am I that you have blessed me in this way? Mephibosheth is saying the same thing. Who am I that you would do this for me? I'm not anybody. And so David had received the kindness of God. Jesus told his apostles when he gave them special powers, he says, freely you have received what? Freely give. And so our charity, our love for others, should be a reflection of our understanding that God has been charitable to us and blessed us. We want to be, God blesses us, in fact, to bless others, doesn't he? That's why we have our blessings. And that phrase, David showing the kindness of God here, I think all of that's a beautiful observation. Really good. All right, well, let's go on from there, and we'll look at David's war, if you will, with Ammon and Aram, perhaps Syria, depending on how you want to name them. But I'm talking about the same people either way. We open up in 2 Samuel chapter 10. It happened after this that the king of the people of Ammon died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place. And David said, I'll show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father showed kindness to me. So David sent by the hand of his servants to comfort him concerning his father, and David's servants came into the land of the people of Ammon. So Nahash is the king of Ammon who died. Now, the name Nahash we've run across before in the period of the United Kingdom, and perhaps a little earlier as well. But among the Ammonites, the name Nahash is not so much a personal name, it's the name they have for their king. It's kind of like Pharaoh in Egypt. So Nahash to the Ammonites would be just the name of the guy that's the king, whoever he is. This is almost, most likely, not the Nahash that we have seen earlier on. Could be, but probably not. In any case, David's moved to send representatives to console Hanun, Nahash's son, who now has lost his father and is taking the throne. His motivation was that Nahash had previously shown David kindness. That's why David is doing this. We don't know when that happened or what event that refers to. I don't think there's any biblically revealed event that shows the king of Ammon being particularly kind to David. But there must have been maybe sometime when he was on the run or when Saul was chasing him or something where Nahash had helped him out. It would do us well, though, to remember that historically, Israel and Ammon had not been close. They were close neighbors, but they weren't close friends, you might say. They had been at odds in the past many times. We looked during the period of the judges, when there was quite a bit of military struggle, war between the two, between Israel and the people of Ammon. And you might remember it was the people of Ammon that were coming up against Israel, which caused them to call upon Jephthah to rescue them back in the time of the judges. So you have that in Judges chapter 11. And other occasions as well. So here you have ancient relatives of Israel, of course, descending from Lot. They were left in the land by the order of God. They'd been a bit of a thorn in the side of Israel. Yet David is feeling very benevolent, apparently, at this point in his life. And for, you know, because of a kindness that was shown him, he wants to repay that kindness. So he goes and sends gifts of comfort to the new king of Ammon. So this is the area that we're talking about. We'll be looking at Rabbath Ammon here in just a moment. That would be the capital. It still is the capital of a country that is there. Ammon, Jordan is the same place, modern Ammon. And up here to the north are the Syrians, kingdom of Aram, Damascus, so sometimes called Syrians or Arameans, depending on during this time period. And both of those kingdoms are going to come into this story just briefly. So Hanun's advisors convince him that David isn't trying to be nice. He's got a sinister plot. If you look at 2 Samuel 10 and verse 3, the princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanun, their lord, do you think that David really honors your father because he has sent comforters to you? Has David not rather sent his servants to you to search the city, to spy it out, and to overthrow it? So they're suspicious. They have, probably not nice thoughts about the kingdom of Israel. They have evil suspicions, and they relay those to their king, and he, unfortunately, acts upon their advice. He treats David's servants with contempt, to say the least. The verse 4 says, Hanun took David's servants, shaved off half their beards, cut off their garments in the middle at the buttocks, and sent them away. You know, I've heard of college hazings and stuff like that that weren't nearly as bad as what was done to these messengers that David sent. But just extremely insulting. Anybody could see that by looking at this. This is a very insulting thing that was done to these men. God had rules and regulations, of course, about shaving beards and so on and so forth for the Israelites. It was very important that those things be done properly according to the law, and having your beard half shaved off would just be more than embarrassing. You'd be ridiculed and thought to be unholy and lots of other things as well. So it's shameful for these men to have experienced this, and they're not even wanting to come back home. They go to Jericho, and David tells them, just wait in Jericho till your beards grow back, because we don't want you to have to come home and experience all the embarrassment of what's been done to you. But this, of course, gets David's ire up, to say the least. He's been insulted, and his messengers have been embarrassed. And so he's going to respond, and there's going to be a war. There have been wars that have been started over less, I suppose. but this war is going to be somewhat protracted. You don't necessarily get that right out of the text in 2 Samuel, but comparing some of the texts, both in 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles, there must have been three separate campaigns that David makes against first the Ammonites and then those who are in league with them. And the first of those is found here in the middle of 2 Samuel 10. Then you have the last part of 2 Samuel 10, you have another campaign. It's apparent it's not exactly the same. It's a later one. And then yet another one that is actually going on, interestingly enough, when David stays home and commits the sin with Bathsheba. They are still fighting the Ammonites in chapters 11 and 12 when David commits that sin. So this battle, as I said, gets to be somewhat protracted and goes in these campaigns. Here you have then a map of the area, give you kind of an idea of where we're talking about with Ammon. Here, straight across basically from Jericho, across the Jordan, you have Rabbath Ammon there, the capital. So let's quickly look at how these campaigns progress, if we can. Wow, did I do that? I guess I did. Where am I? This is a quick review of everything we've talked about tonight. okay. Got to be careful. I have really fat thumbs. Got to be careful what button I hit here. All right. So Ammon gathers at Rabbath Ammon. And they're going to come against David. You have in verse 6, when the people of Ammon saw that they made themselves repulsive to David, the people of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians of Beth Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and from the king of Maacah, 1,000 men, and from Ishtob, 12,000 men. And so they're hiring mercenaries to fight with them. And they have all these troops come together, and they gather at their capital city. And David puts Joab in charge of Israel's forces, the mighty men, as the text in Chronicles calls them. And they go out to fight this collection, this army, at Rabbath Ammon. This is the road they would have taken, the way they would have taken to fight that battle. This is heading into what is now Jordan, modern Ammon, to where the battle would be fought. So you can just imagine the troops of Israel being led, you know, up this valley, up to those mountains, and just on the far side of that mountain is where Ammon is. This would be the very territory that they would have traversed to get to the battle. So you have this first campaign. Joab and Abishai, his brother, realize how large a force now that they're facing. I don't think they were counting on this when they went to take care of the Ammonites. And so they get there, and they're uncertain, to say the least, of how this might turn out. Let me read to you this interesting passage right here. Joab saw that the battle line was against him. This is verse 9 of chapter 10. Against him before and behind. So they're basically surrounded. He chose some of Israel's best and put them in battle array against the Syrians, and the rest of the people he put under the command of Abishai, his brother, that he might set them in battle array against the people of Ammon. And he said, "If the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the people of Ammon are too strong for you, then I will come to help you." Please notice that he does not say, "If they're too strong for both of us, here's what we're going to do." That's not in the plan here. Although probably it was a likelihood from a military standpoint that they were going to be too strong for both of them. But Joab doesn't mention that. He's a great general, okay? You don't want to talk about the possibility of defeat. So, you know, we'll come help you if you need it. You come help us if we need it. And then he tells them, verse 12 is just a beautiful verse. "Be of good courage. Let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what is good in his sight." I just love that. That is Aragorn and Lord of the Rings times 10, okay? Just standing, and we're going to fight men of the West, so to speak. We're going to win this battle. And it's just a great statement that Joab makes, showing his faith in God. Joab is a man who has a lot, he's a man of war, but he has a lot of faith in God. And you kind of see that. He'd be an interesting character study. I've never preached a lesson on Joab. I think I need to do that. He'd be a really interesting character study. He's got a lot of strengths. So the Syrians and the Ammonites, sure enough, both of them flee before Joab and Abishai, respectively. And so the forces of Israel win the day. And at the end of verse 14, Joab returns to Jerusalem. So that's the end of that first campaign, but it's not over. After their defeat to Joab, Hadadezer solicits help of other Arameans, and he gathers to attack Israel at Helam. That is not a place that we know where it is, but anyway, they did in the day. And David himself then goes out to meet them. Again, they flee. David winds up killing 700 charioteers and 40,000 horsemen. That is, you know, again, we were comparing some of these numbers to the numbers we're seeing in the Israel-Hamas war right now. It's terrible to lose one person in war. Several thousand, I think, have been lost in Israel and the Gaza Strip right now. But you talk about 40,000 people being wiped out in a battle. That's huge. And so David and his forces win a mighty victory on this occasion. So Aram decides they're making peace with David. They're not going to go down this road anymore. And that kind of gets them out of play militarily. But the Ammonites themselves still are not finished, have not been finished off, and have their capital city still standing. So in the spring, David sends Joab to besiege Rabbah, Ammon's chief city. You can see that that's kind of what's going on in 2 Samuel 11 when that opens up. It happens in the spring of the year at the time when kings go out to war, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. David remained in Jerusalem. Of course, we know what's going to happen next, but before we get to Bathsheba, see what's going on with this warfare. It's still going on between Israel and Ammon. So after surrounding the city, this isn't recorded until after the incident with Bathsheba. So we know some long time goes on for all of that to occur that occurred with Bathsheba. After that kind of gets through, Joab sends word to David in 2 Samuel chapter 12 and says, "I've surrounded the city. We can take it, but if I take it, I'm going to get all the credit. You're going to get none of the credit. Why don't you come so you can get the credit for winning this victory?" And so David does that. You see that 2 Samuel 12, verses 26 through 31. So David goes, they capture Rabbah. David takes possession of the crown of the Ammonite king. It weighed a talent of gold, this huge gold crown, other things, other spoils, and they execute many of the people of Rabbah. So there's a kind of a final victory over the Ammonites that took a long time to succeed. We focus in this section of Scripture, of course, on David's sin with Bathsheba. The background of these wars is seldom looked at, but it's fascinating to me that all of this was going on. God had a hand in Israel's victories, for sure, was leading them in victory, and all of this was going on while the palace intrigue was also happening at the same time. So David is solidifying his kingdom. The nations around that he subjugated, that we talked about in the last lesson, they continue to be subjugated to him. And if they rebel, he puts them down with great force. And so here tonight we've seen the Ammonites, rebelling against David's domination, and yet they're not able to withstand him. A couple of applications as we conclude tonight. We've mentioned this a couple of times. It's just an honorable thing to honor a promise that you've made, even if it's somebody that's passed away. Honor that promise. Do it with zeal. Do it because it's the right thing to do. Hanan made a mistake of heeding bad advice which came from evil suspicions of his counselors. I want to tell you what. It's easy to make mistakes when you listen to the wrong people or you listen to evil suspicions in your own head. We need to be really cautious about the kind of counsel that we listen to. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly. David would seldom walk in the counsel of the ungodly. But you see a foreign prince here that listened to his ministers, ungodly thinkers, and it cost him his whole kingdom eventually. So there's a great lesson right there. All right, anything else before we quit? I see the kids are coming back. Somebody have another comment? All right, thank you for your attention and help tonight. We'll pick up there then Sunday morning.